Welcome to season 2 of Let's Break Up, Toxic Workplace Stories. Join hosts Nicola and Gina as they tackle workplace toxicity head-on. Real-life stories, well-being, and standing against toxicity await you. Let's break up with toxic workplaces and create a revolution of positivity together.
As a disclaimer, Nicola and Gina's opinions are solely their own and don't represent professional advice. It's just their perspective, so form your own conclusions. Heads up. This podcast may contain adult content and explicit language. So let's dive in and break up with toxic workplaces.
Good morning, Stephen.
Hey, Nicola. Hey, Gina. How are you doing?
Hey, good. How are
you? And yourself?
Oh, good. I'm glad this worked. I'm doing well. I'm doing very well. Good. Yeah, it's been a while. It's been a while since we talked. I think it was...
Yeah, we got a little sidetracked there.
We definitely got sidetracked. Stephen, would you like to introduce your lovely self?
Yes, tell us about who you are and what you do.
Sure. I'm super glad to be on, Gina and Nicola. It's great to see you doing this podcast. I feel like there needs to be more talking about toxic workplaces. So I'm glad you're doing it. Thanks for having me on. I am an employment attorney. I almost exclusively represent employees against employers in California. I'm based in Oakland, California. And so I do a lot of dispute resolution on behalf of employees who have endured all sorts of toxic workplaces, much of which is illegal, discrimination, retaliation, harassment, sexual harassment, those types of things that people endure in the workplace, and try to get them some sort of resolution that's fair and that tries to hold some of these companies accountable. So that's me in a nutshell.
All right. I like it. So what are some of, I don't know if you're allowed to say, but have you done like any Aaron Brockovich stuff, like really big companies you've won against? Like you see all these movies, right? And it's like someone uncovers like illegal gas or oil dumping, you know, that's like poisoning a town.
Illegal gambling ring in their underground warehouse.
Have you done anything like wild like that?
I don't know about wild, but I being in the Bay Area is fun because chances are you'll go up against big tech companies. So I've had cases against Meta. I've had cases against Apple, Google, sort of every name your tech company, there's cases against them.
Of course.
Which is fun.
Yeah.
Now, and then, but sometimes, you know, those companies at least have some sort of mechanism. They have processes in place. They're so big. They have tons of lawyers, tons of HR people. Some of the more interesting cases are smaller entities that don't know what they're doing, that don't have an HR consultant or lawyers on staff. And so auto body shops, sports coaches for high schoolers, you know, like those types of employer-employee relationships sometimes are juicier cases just because the employer's not as prepared for when issues come
up. For you. They're not prepared for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. They think they can get away with it. And they usually can until something happens and someone thinks, oh, I should do something about this.
What's been your most, what do you feel has been, I'm going to say, your most impactful case so far?
I've had a few cases this year involving leaves, and in California and in the U.S. generally, you get protected leave for maternity and paternity leave, and you get 12 weeks. It doesn't necessarily have to be paid, but your employer can't retaliate against you for taking the leave, and so you're entitled to your job when you come back. And so I've had a few mothers or fathers come and they were working. They told their employer, hey, I'm about to have this new baby, take off. And either some of them, it's been during the leave, some of them, it's been right after the leave. The employer decides that they don't want them, that they never needed them, and they terminate them. And those cases, I think, for whatever reason, for me, hearing people take what they think is going to be protected time off to bond with their new baby, only to be fired and never get that time back, for particularly for those who have been fired during the leave. So maybe they're 6 weeks into a 12-week leave and they're notified that they're terminated, not only do they have to go find a new job, but also they lose forever, really, that the extra 6 weeks of protected leave. And so finding some sort of resolution for them, I think, has been probably the most rewarding
type of case. You prove that they're fired because they took their leave? Because, of course, I'm assuming the companies are somewhat smart enough to be like, oh, no, we just did like an evaluation of all positions and we realized it's redundant or restructuring or whatever. So I'm assuming the employment, whoever the company might be, would come back with that, right? If you're like, well, are you sure you didn't fire me because I took maternity/paternity leave? How do you prove that it was because they took the leave?
It's never easy, and being in California is helpful because you get really friendly judges and juries in California for employees, but it's challenging. The company will always come up with reasons when they hire attorneys. It's those attorneys' job to put every possibility on the table of why there was some other reason that they terminated the employee. And usually I think the timeline speaks for itself. The employee had never had any issues with performance. It wasn't a mass layoff. So it wasn't like we got rid of, 60% of the company. It wasn't like Twitter where, we're getting rid of almost everyone. So yes, some people are going to be on maternity leave when they're fired. These are individuals who are terminated. No one else was terminated. They never had performance issues in the tire during leave or within a few weeks or even a couple months after the leave. And the timeline speaks for itself. And you get reasonable judges and juries who are going to see that timeline and understand that there's really only one reason.
Conclusion. Yeah. Okay. So what has been some of your more challenging cases in terms of, an employee being a whistleblower, so to speak, whether it's they had the what's the word I'm looking for? I'm like, side note, I'm stuck on stupid today. I'm very slow and I don't know why. I slept like way too many hours last night. I can't form a sentence. Stupid. My workout this morning took me double the time it normally did. Cause I'm like, I've been staring off into space for 10 minutes in between sets. So this is going to be rough. So what I'm trying to say is, what has been some of the more challenging aspects to proving employer discrimination or toxicity or whatever word you want to assign it? What has been some of the more challenging ones?
With respect to toxic environments, Gina, the biggest challenge is that a lot of people experience toxic workplaces that aren't necessarily unlawful workplaces. And so
what that might look like.
I talked to probably a dozen or two employees a week doing intake calls and trying to learn about if they have cases, and so many people had negative interactions with their supervisors or with colleagues. But I'm not able to determine, is this just a supervisor that you didn't agree with that treated you unfairly, that made a bad business decision? Because bad business decisions are bad business decisions, but it's not unlawful. It has, harassment has to rise to the level of being a hostile work environment, being severe and pervasive, being based on your religion, your race, your ethnicity, those types of things, at least here in California. And so often there's just a lot of bad managers out there who didn't get any training on being a manager and who just are bad at their jobs. And there's often no case for that. It's just you got yourself into a situation where, you have a really bad manager.
Mm-hmm. So what for you when you're doing these screening calls, what is your litmus test? Like, what sort of questions are you asking people when they're calling so that, when people do call, what should they be prepared with? And kind of what is your litmus test of, this is bad, let's go?
I I'm always trying to think about from the moment that potential clients call in is what would this look like if there were a trial or, you know, there were a hearing on the matter? What could we prove? And so a lot of times we had this conversation on the phone. I had a conversation on the phone with my supervisor and they made a comment about my weight. And it was a one-off comment and it was isolated and it's awful. It's awful. But it wasn't in writing. I never reported it. It happened a year ago. And yeah, it happened. And I believe them, but it's going to be more challenging to prove. And so that's going to be a conversation with the client or the potential client of how can we build that evidence? You know, will they say it again? Have they said it to anyone else? You know, were there any witnesses, those types of things? Alternatively, sometimes people put that stuff in writing. They write it on Slack. They write it on Teams. They put it in emails. Or they say it in front of witnesses. Then there's a case because now we have things that we can use to prove and to actually show a judge or a jury, here are the things, you know, that are discriminatory. And so I think trying to get to the bottom of what that evidence is. And people don't call saying, here's all my evidence. You know, I have a packet of screenshots and things like that, because people aren't thinking that way, but trying to get people to think that way is important from the get-go.
So what do you think? And I know when we first, like, however long ago, we briefly touched on this when we chatted with you. How do you know, like, how do you handle, hold on, you're going to have to edit that part out. When someone, what is the tipping point? That's the word I'm looking for. When someone would call you, like, what is generally the tipping point? Like, is it something big or is it that they're just realizing that this whole workplace or the relationship they're calling you about is problematic? Like, what does that look like typically?
Typically?
Yeah.
It's typically, I think I'm about to be fired or if I was just terminated and all this stuff happens. Right. That's usually when it comes out. And I think a lot of people have been experiencing it, enduring it for a long time, and they haven't necessarily recognized it as discrimination, harassment, or retaliation. And they're letting it happen because, one, they want this job to work out. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be that person who rocks the boat with their employer. And there are good things about their job. Maybe they like the work, but there's this one supervisor that's awful, or they like the fact that they get to work from home, but they hate getting the emails from this one person. So, you know, I think a lot of people kind of, they start weighing it, and only when things really blow up to the point of being fired or demoted, do they call. That's usually the case. Now, sometimes there's people who are a little bit more proactive or, you know, just wanting to get a consultation. And I think I wish that happened more often. I think people should reach out more often, because the only way to really educate yourself about what's happening is lawful or not at that time is to reach out to someone like me in whatever state or country you're in. And so I wish people knew to do it earlier.
And I think we did. Go ahead, Nicholas.
I was going to say, so earlier the better. So if you start seeing rumblings of something weird unfolding, it's better to give you a call and you can then say, this is the stuff that you need to look out for. Here's a list of things that you need to start eyeballing in your Slack team / emails, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Here are the things you should start documenting. Here are the things you should make sure there are witnesses present for. Here are the things you shouldn't do. And so the earlier, the better. And most lawyers give out free consultations when they're assessing a case. And so, you should be able to find that for free, and it's worth the hour of searching for a lawyer and having a conversation with the lawyer, just to make sure that you're doing everything you can so that on the back end, if you do have a case, you're sort of as well prepared as possible.
What are some of the things that you would recommend people start documenting?
I pretty much, and maybe you can agree with this from your prior work experiences, Nicola and Gina, I pretty much tell people to go ahead and throw away anything that didn't happen in writing. So any phone call people are going to either lie about or really, people have very different perspectives when they remember a phone call or an in-person meeting. And so unless there are witnesses there, and or unless it's in writing, who knows what people are going to say mm-hmm. months down the road when their goals change, but now they're trying to protect themselves, or they're trying to protect the company that they work for. So with that, you know, I always recommend people report things in writing, over email, to mm-hmm. human resources, to the highest person possible within human resources. And then in terms of any sort of discriminatory or harassing comment that's made, I recommend reporting it and asking for any witness to say, you know, yes, this is what I heard too. So it's not just you, but there's other people who contemporaneously right. said, oh yeah, I heard that too. And if you get that in writing, your case suddenly becomes a lot stronger because you can prove it. And that's what matters. There's the truth, and then there's the provable truth. And the provable truth is at the end of the day what matters in lawsuits and litigation.
So what is the difference, and I'm actually asking for myself, between someone's opinion of you as an employee and discrimination? Like, I remember, because we're talking and I'm like thinking, like, I always like to try to like test myself, like, did I do this? Could I have been the toxic one? And it's like, I remember writing on Slack to someone, well, I don't think she's like, I don't think she's a true business person. She's making poor business decisions. Is that discriminatory or is that just my opinion? Granted, I should have never said it, period. And it was to someone under me. I was just at my wit's end at this company. And I was just like, whatever, like word vomiting. I was like, I can't stand it anymore. But like, what is the line?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Our podcast is powered by the seamless one-click installation and WordPress starter wizard from SiteGround. Choose from pro designs, add contact forms, online stores, portfolios, all automated, no tech stress. Say goodbye to mundane setups and hello to a stunning podcast platform. Join us on Let's Break Up Toxic Workplace Stories and let SiteGround handle the digital stage for you. Launch your podcast website effortlessly, because breaking up with toxicity starts here.
There's no line. The line is what a jury ends up thinking at the end of the day. And so they're going to take that in the context of everything else. And if they're able to say, oh, you know, Gina said that, and it was substantially motivated by that person's race or that person's religion or that person's sex, then it's discriminatory. If alternatively, if it has nothing to do with those factors, then it's your opinion, and you're allowed to say it, and it's about
like what this person was, what their gender, rate, like, I don't care. I don't even think I knew, because we were all remote, but I just like saw them making business decisions that I felt were really poor in terms of the company getting to where they wanted it to go. And I was like, who would do this? Like, I'm so confused. Like, this doesn't make sense to me. So I guess the takeaway there, right, is that it has to be motivated by orientation, creed, sex, denomination, politics, weight, race, any of those like kind of hot button aspects. But if they just suck as a business person, then it could be anyone.
Stupid.
Yeah.
You're just stupid.
And there should be space. There really should be space in a healthy workplace, right? There should be space for people to give feedback and to give, you know, feedback upwards, downwards, across to peers, supervisors, supervisees. And that should be happening on a regular basis. And it should be honest. It should be candid. And it should be specific. And sometimes that's going to look like this person makes bad business decisions. Right. And here's reason, example one, example two, example three. That's not based on anything. You should be in a really good place as an employer or as a supervisor. And that's why people document things. And if you have that in writing, and you can then show, look, this wasn't based on someone's race or sex. This is based on these specific instances of them just being a bad business person or making bad decisions.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's actually helpful, because you know, but then how do you prove intent, I guess, with the facts, right? Because like anyone can be like, oh, well, I didn't mean it because it's a woman, or I didn't mean it because she's underweight or overweight, whatever. You know, you could always go back on that. But how do you prove intent?
People are going to be, judges, juries are going to be reasonable. They're going to start looking at, you know, has this person made comments in the past? Have other people complained about this person? Have, you know, are these comments, is Gina, the supervisor, making these comments about every single person on their team, or just this one person? You know, and they're going to end up having to make a conclusion or a guess on your intent.
Right.
And from my side, representing employees, all we have to prove is that it's more likely than not. It's not like you hear about criminal cases that are beyond a reasonable doubt. You have to prove someone committed a crime. That's not the case. That's not the burden here in our world of civil law. It's just preponderance of evidence, which means more likely than not. So all you have to do is say more than 50% chance that this happened, and we win. And so at the end of the day, there's a lot of risk for employers because more than 50% likely is just not that high to prove.
It's not. Yeah.
That's wild. All right.
So I know. Go ahead, Nicola. I feel like you're working on something over there that you're about to launch at us.
I'm not launching. But I'm okay. Being in California, I am pretty confident. And also being a lawyer, I feel like you were pretty all over like the Lizzo allegations.
Yeah, I know them. I'm familiar with them. I don't know the ins and outs, but.
So we had, I feel like the year is like blending together at this point. Was it last week that we did a live on LinkedIn?
I think it was, yeah.
Whenever it was. Anyway, we did a kind of a deep dive into the submission that the plaintiffs had made to, which it was one of the counties in Los Angeles. I don't know how your stupid counties work. What do I know in New Zealand? What do I know? There's a county. I don't know.
But it's governed by the state of California. So the rules would be applicable to the whole state. Doesn't matter the county. That's just where, right? That's where it was filed. Am I right in saying that, yeah. Stephen?
That's right. And I think it was filed in the Superior Court of the County of Los Angeles. So each county has its own court, but the state law is primarily governing.
It's the governance. Okay.
What do I know?
We don't know shit about
three courts. We're like, we got like a court, like the regional court, the high court, and the Supreme Court.
Do you guys wear the white wigs?
God, fun. Yes, we
do.
Do
you?
We do.
You do. We don't. We can just show up. Like, we can show up in whatever.
I think only in the Supreme Court they do the cool wigs. Mm. That's totally irrelevant.
Well, anyway. Here in America, nobody does wigs. Would you like to wear a wig, Stephen? We're totally on a tangent. But
are you wearing a wig?
Would you wear one of those like old school wigs that you see?
No, I wouldn't. I would not want to. But there is something about being in the courtroom and having a judge wearing a black robe, and the judge is usually on a kind of a level above you. And I think when, you know, lawsuits and the law is a very serious topic, and there is something to be said about the decorum and the costumes people wear, and lawyers wear suits. There's something to be said there. I think it's a little ridiculous. During the pandemic, there were some judges who were doing remote proceedings who wouldn't talk to lawyers if they weren't wearing ties. And meanwhile, it was 2020 and in the middle of the pandemic.
People are just trying to get through a day, right? So it's like, who cares if you're wearing a tie?
Wasn't
like,
there that judge who accidentally had like the cat filter? Yeah,
a reporter, a lawyer, or a judge? It was one of those three, and they did the whole like thing like as a cat on Zoom or a hamster or something.
I'm like, yes, this is what we need in our lives. Anyway, circling back,
there was also that right at the beginning, right when the Supreme Court of the United States went remote for the pandemic, they were doing not video but just audio, and there was a famous toilet flush, and no one knows exactly which of the 9 Supreme Court justices did it, but you can only speculate.
I never heard about that. That's amazing. Who do you think it was?
I don't know. I have my guesses, but I don't want to say them.
Okay.
I don't want to be on the record saying them. So.
Wait, wasn't there something, or was it some politician like farted politic. On
some politician?
I'm retarded today. I edit that out. Because I can't say that word anymore. I'm a child of the 80s. Everyone, leave me alone. There was a politician who farted. Like, was it Trump? I should know this, but I don't know this. Somebody, like, during the pandemic, it was something virtual, and, like, it was all over the internet, and it was like, was that a fart? Like, nobody Okay, we digress.
Rerun the tape. Yeah, it wouldn't be surprising if it were Trump.
I feel like it wouldn't be surprising.
No.
Anywho, circling back. Okay, so I have got the Lizzo thing open over here. And a lot of their stuff in, they've got a list of what they've called factual allegations. I'm like, okay, cute. But a lot
Wait,
of-
what? Can you break down what a factual allegation is? Is that actually a legal term?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Before we dive back into uncovering the complexities of toxic workplaces, we have an important request for you. If you find our discussions eye-opening and thought-provoking, consider subscribing to Let's Break Up, Toxic Workplace Stories. Subscribing not only ensures you catch every episode, but also helps us reach a broader audience with our message of positivity and change. But that's not all. Leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform goes a long way in spreading awareness about the impact of toxic workplaces on individuals and the solutions we explore together.
So, yeah, I don't know what you're looking at, Nicola, but it sounds
you know
like
what?
It
I
was...
will, I will share it with you, girlfriend.
Oh,
hold
wonderful.
On. Hold on. Give me a second.
But have you heard that terminology before? Factual allegation? That seems like it's an oxymoron.
It is. And so usually what happens is the plaintiff, the person suing, the employee in this context, is going to submit a complaint. That's the beginning of a lawsuit.
I've just
and in that
in
complaint, okay, I'll take a look. In that complaint, they'll say, these are all the things that we're alleging are facts. And throughout the next 3 years of litigation, we're going to prove each and every one of these facts. And they're going to turn essentially from allegations to facts that are proven. And so people make the shorthand factual allegations, which is a bit of a oxymoron. They're almost opposites. But the goal is to take those allegations that we claim are true and actually proving them to be facts that other people agree with.
It sounds like it's saying like, yes, we're alleging this, but we have factual information to back it up. So that's why it's a factual allegation. And, and during the proceedings, should we go to trial, we'll be able to prove it. Because if you
and
settle out of court, right, isn't that usually what happens? How often, now I'm on a different tangent here, but how often do you actually go into litigation? Because that's typically lengthy and expensive for everyone, right?
Yep, it's not very common, particularly in the employment realm. And so often, you know, anyone can file a lawsuit, and there's tons and tons and tons of frivolous lawsuits, unfortunately, in employment law. And it doesn't look good for plaintiffs' lawyers like me, because employee lawyers, because I have, you know, colleagues across the state, some of whom will take any case and file a lawsuit, and it's completely BS. And they call them factual allegations also, and then they would never be able to prove them. And so it's hard for when, you know, the media takes this complaint against Lizzo, you know, these people can just be saying these things. We don't know. I personally believe them, but I think they're going to have to prove it, and it's likely going to settle outside of court, and the public is not really going to get a clear picture of what happened
is how it
usually ends.
Right. So have you actually ended up going, you yourself, gone into litigation with any of your clients?
Yeah, so I have cases in litigation, and a lot of it's back and forth information sharing, which is called discovery. Sure. And so, you know, there'll be an allegation in the complaint, in the factual allegation section. It will say something like, you know, on this date, Lizzo did X. You know, she did some sexual harassment, some harassment yes. based on weight, I think. And then it's how do you go proving that? So we'll ask for all the documents from Lizzo, all the emails that she sent, and destroying emails at that point would be a crime. So she has a duty to turn over.
So you're going in and you're deleting emails is going to come bite you.
That's a big no-no. Yeah.
So after it's filed in the court system, right? Like, let's say like you're just doing maintenance in your email inbox and you're just deleting things from like 2018 or something, because I hoard all my emails.
I'm aware.
Prior to any kind of filing in a court system, that's not illegal. It's after the filing happens, correct?
The safest thing to do would be as soon as someone's aware of anticipated legal claims to hold all their evidence and not destroy anything. That could happen once the lawsuit's filed. Sometimes it happens beforehand because an attorney sends a letter saying, you know, we're going to file a lawsuit. Please hold all your evidence. After that point, if you destroy evidence,
it's illegal.
It's illegal. It could be a crime. That it'll be, if there's anything that's missing, it will be deemed to be in the favor of the other side. And so it also has consequences that people start assuming that what you deleted was evidence. You didn't want people to see. So they'll look through Lizzo's emails and text messages and, you know, phone records, things like that. And they'll take her deposition under oath. And so they'll say, you know, they'll spend a day or 2 days or 3 days with Lizzo asking, you know, what happened and where these things happened. And they'll show her proof that they have. Maybe they have screenshot, you know, photos or video recordings of some of this awful sexual harassment. And they'll confront her with it and they'll say, you know, is this you here?
Is this you in this picture that is actually you?
Right. And that sort of stuff. And you're under oath and it's not fun to be.
I don't think it's me.
Deposed,
it's a little blurry, perfectly pixelated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I neither am a fan of Lizzo or against, but I, for some reason, I follow her on Instagram. I don't know if I do anymore, but somehow I was at one point, and her Instagram feed is highly sexualized, and it is also surrounding like her weight in a positive way. Like she's saying, like, you know, just because I'm overweight, or she doesn't feel she's overweight, or she doesn't mind showing her body. So just based on that information, which is very shitty information, I wouldn't be surprised that if these allegations ended up being completely truthful, because there is something very sexual about the way she operates.
With these particular allegations, it wasn't just the sexual harassment, right? It wasn't just the
no, it was also weight and
no, it was
monetary.
Also the pay that they had. So they were on like holding pay. But the dancers weren't getting any, I don't know what it's called in America, but like
it was almost like it's almost like a retainer, right?
Yeah, like a retainer, like, to do the dancing.
You can't take other jobs during this period. Even though you're not currently dancing with us, you're not allowed to leave until your contract's up or whatever. So they didn't have any sort of like retainer pay, for lack of a better word. And they're saying that they wanted to get that, which seems fair because all the other like full-time dancers were getting the retainer pay.
So Section 40, this year, the team submitted their request for a retainer of 50% of their weekly tour rate to ensure they would be paid for their time while on break from touring, since whatever, and Lizzo strongly preferred the dance cast not to take on any other jobs during these breaks. And they did, like, so there was a huge pay issue as well. Like, there wasn't just the sexual allegations. It was also around fat shaming, racial discrimination, disability discrimination. There was a bit around, obviously, the pay.
And I think our favorite
What's the difference between like a toxic work environment and a hostile work environment? Because they say hostile quite a bit. And I'm like, that sounds like you're a hostage in your hostile situation.
Yep. Yeah. A few things. Well, a hostile work environment is going to be an environment that's so intolerable that it's severe and pervasive harassment. Which could be one really horrible instance, but usually it's a pattern of it. And it's usually going to be based on someone's sex or race or gender, religion, the things that we've talked about, those protected characteristics. And talk about the power. I mean, how many of those dancers would probably work for free if they, you know, if that was allowed by the law, because they just want to be in Lizzo's presence and it's going to be their big break. And then they're just totally taken advantage of because of that power dynamic. Must have been really intense on the sets.
I feel like it would have been
these music videos and things.
Yeah. And a lot of this happened. What Nicola and I ended up kind of coming to a very general conclusion was a lot of their allegations ended up just being like they were being told what to do on their own time. Like, technically they're not rehearsing, technically they're not performing, but after hours, when you should be able to have your own hobbies, do what you want, there was pressure to continue to go out with
and do
Lizzo
stuff with the crew.
And as an employer, or even as an employee, like, how do you say no? And then what you just said about being in Lizzo's presence and her atmosphere, if there's a fear, I feel like, already ingrained in you, if I say no, maybe they're going to fire me, right? It's that power dynamic. If I say no, I'm going to look like I'm not a team player. Yeah. If I don't do this, what if I miss out on, you know, becoming friends with her and then getting promoted? Like, who knows, right? There's all of that comes with it. So how do you prove that? Like, how do you prove that, you know, those were my thoughts and saying yes, that it wasn't like a yes because you genuinely wanted to go to this strip club with Lizzo?
In January, there's always a spike of calls about Christmas parties, company Christmas parties,
oh,
and all the shenanigans that happens.
Oh my God, we hate those.
But I think it's a good parallel, right? Because, you know, it's, you don't have to go, but there's sort of pressure to go at sometimes, and there's usually alcohol involved, and it usually sort of feels like it's not work at sometimes. And I think that's sort of the situation here with Lizzo is, you know, we're not really at work. So everyone kind of puts their guards down, and technically speaking, you know, employers are responsible for what's in the scope of their employment. When supervisors like Lizzo and her manager, I think, are doing things within the scope of their employment, and they're going to argue, I'm sure those LA attorneys are going to argue very hard that, you know, anything that happened at a bar or outside of work has nothing to do with the employment.
But that's not really true.
Right.
And we all know that.
On the flip side. Yep. And the courts have given a good amount of leeway to things that happen off the work site, as long as it was a work event, somewhat work sponsored. You know, if a supervisor says, hey, we're all going straight from the office here, those are the types of things that are going to be a little bit more gray. But generally speaking, there's been a pretty good amount of leeway for liability for the employer when they're, you know, taking their employees out to a different place and putting their guards down and talking about, you know, asking about their virginity and they're talking about dildos. I mean, all sorts of just crazy things that they alleged in the Lizzo complaint that you sent me.
So, yeah, there's some wild allegations in there, right?
Our favorite, right, Nicola? We read this in depth. There was one that one of the dancers alleged they were not allowed to go to the bathroom during rehearsal, and it was like a 12-hour rehearsal, and they ended up peeing their pants, essentially, and then they were given a sparkly see-through body stocking by wardrobe. to where, like, I guess home or for the rest of the day.
Get inside. It's horrifying.
I guess for me, it's like, it sounds so fucking weird that it has to be true, right? Like, who's going to come up with that?
All we had was like an absolute sheer, like, we can see all of your bits, body stocking. Oh, we didn't, I didn't have a spare pair of sweatpants in my training kit.
Yeah, it's like, so I don't know, like, knowing the very little that you do know about this particular complaint, or is it a complaint or an allegation at this point?
It's a complaint. It's a law.
Okay. It's a complaint.
The allegations are put in a document called the complaint, and once it's filed, it becomes a lawsuit. Opening, sort of the opening document of a lawsuit. It's how you start the process.
It's the lid. It's the lid on the can of worms.
So based on what you know, which we can all agree is all very limited, and our retelling of situations
terrible.
This reminds me, Joe's my partner, our listeners know this. I told him like a year ago, I was like, you gotta watch this show, it's about, and he's like, what is it about? And I forget the name of the show now because this is a while ago, and I was like, it was about somebody getting raped in the woods, like, by, and it was like then covered up by all of these women at a brewery or something. So he's like, okay, I'm gonna watch the show. He's like, two episodes in, he's like, first of all, nobody was raped. This is like eyewitness testimony, right? It's like, this is why it doesn't work, because I watched the fucking show and I still got the whole premise wrong. Anyway, so that's us retelling you the Lizzo bits. It's like, I don't really believe anything that comes out of our mouth.
Fair enough. I mean, but I have a gist that, and I feel like it's been the news enough that I feel like we've all heard about it a little bit.
Yeah.
I will say this, you know, often it's sort of like, what's the end goal? And here it's probably about money. It's probably about these dancers aren't making a lot of money. A lot of employers have insurance specifically for cases like this. Employment practices liability insurance. EPLI insurance. And so how much does it impact the company? You know, when this stuff happens, they file an insurance claim like you might do for a car accident, and their insurance flips the bill and their premiums go up. Now sometimes insurance won't cover it, or, you know, it's going to come right out of their pocket, but generally speaking, it's like, what's the end goal? And I feel like here it's money, but it's also, let's expose Lizzo's sort of operation for what it is. And so it'll be interesting if they want to settle quickly, and is this really about money? I think it will settle quickly. If it's less about money and it's more about, let's really expose all the wrongdoing for Lizzo, I think it will last for years, and there'll be a lot of back and forth discovery where information will come out.
Interesting. I'm curious to know, one of the things that they bring up a couple of times in this document, and this happened at our workplace as well, so I'm interested to know just like what your thoughts are on this. Is one of the things that they brought up was always the commentary about that jobs aren't safe. Everybody's got to be on, you know, their best behavior because the jobs aren't safe. And Lizzo mentions it here. She does a couple of comments here, especially in April. She goes, she told everybody that their jobs weren't safe, and that drinking alcohol before the show was prohibited. And there was like a bunch of things that she said along that line as well. But I'm curious to know, like, when a leader or a manager says that to the team, obviously it's going to demoralize the team, like, of course, but what, like, is that something that they shouldn't be doing? Like, what's the kind of, what is the legal aspect of that?
I don't know for these dancers, for Lizzo, because I'm not sure if they were in a union or something like that, but typically, and I know you're talked about this a bunch of times on your podcast about being an at-will employee. So in California, the vast, vast majority of non-union employees are at-will. And so they can be terminated for any reason, no reason at all. And their employers can remind them that. And I agree, Nicola, it's horrible for morale. But there's nothing really unlawful about it until it's tied to something else. If you're threatening their termination unless they do something that's illegal, that's when it starts to become more of an issue. But I think there was an instance this spring or last fall of Mark Zuckerberg saying, you know, telling all the Meta employees, your job's not safe. You know, we're going to be cutting and we're going to decide who gets cut. And it's horrible for morale. I mean, you go home to your family thinking, oh, I might lose my job any day.
And it's just stressful. Like, it creates additional stress that probably isn't even needed.
But would you rather not be warned that they're going to be coming up on, like, massive layoffs, like in the case of Meta?
That's where change management is really important, right? Like, do it in the right way. Say, look, we're doing a review. We know that we have to save $40 million. This is how we're going to save $40 million. One of these interventions that we're going to use is to cut some jobs, but we're going to go through a rigorous process. Everybody's going to have the opportunity to provide feedback. And this is the change management process we're going to use.
And what ends up happening is it's a lot of favoritism, a lot of, you know, I like this person, even though it's not tied to any real objectives or metrics or anything like that. And yeah, those are how decisions are unfortunately often made.
Yeah, I would agree with that, especially in America, because I don't think America, like corporate America, for lack of better terminology, has a good handle on change management.
I don't think they would know what change management was if they put them in the
ass. I think it's a word, you know, like I remember years ago when I was starting to like think, oh, maybe I want a different job, whatever. Like all of these acronyms, like KPIs, like, bleh, and it's like, oh, you just want to, and benchmark, let's benchmark it. It's like, oh, you want to compare prices. Just fucking say compare prices. Like, let's not like, you know, fluff what it actually is. Okay, you want to get two different quotes from two different vendors and see who's cheaper for the exact same item. Great. Like, they're calling it benchmarking and everyone calls something different, you know, something completely different. So it's like, I feel like change management is a buzzword that just means like, how are we going to keep our employers and employees on the same page in terms of what's happening at a higher level, right? And I don't think Americans are good at that. Maybe I'm wrong, but I've never been part of an organization that has been particularly good with being transparent about what they're doing, why, and how they're going to arrive at the decision, what you just described. And I think that's very typical of American employers. And I think, Stephen, you would agree with me. What are your thoughts?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there isn't a lot of transparency. And I think some of that sometimes has to do with once you start telling employees things, they start talking, they start questioning, and there's little rebellions that sort of happen. Mm-hmm. And I think companies are really worried about that and like to safeguard decisions on sort of a as needed basis to know. And I mean, from the sort of pessimistic capitalist viewpoint, these, you know, they think it's best for profits as if we make decisions this way and we, you know, our employees just work for us. We pay them the salary and they're not entitled to this information.
So here in New Zealand, just as a...
Oh, yeah.
Here in New Zealand. Just here, down in our little freezing cold little bucket of joy. So we have to, by law, go through a change management process, which includes consultation, fair process, selection criteria, consulting with any unions if they're involved, notice and severance. We offer alternative employment should that be an option, redundancy compensation, and then obviously we've got to make sure that we're keeping records of.
Wow,
that sounds amazing, right, Steven?
Wow. Like, yeah, that
in America does that.
It's unheard of. It's such a better society.
It's very difficult to fire people here. Firing someone is incredibly hard. So unless you are like a serial killer and you have murdered people in your office, which is serious misconduct, getting someone fired is really tricky. So it's pretty much serious misconduct serious things will get you into trouble.
Oh, huh. We had someone from New Zealand tell us that it was proven that this guy, it was the EOS woman. She was in a workplace that she realized that all the higher ups knew that Kevin Smith or whoever it was embezzling. They had proof, but they weren't going, they couldn't fire him for whatever reason. I forget what was the reason. Like,
I can't remember what we'd have to go back.
There was a reason that kind of made sense.
Yeah.
But they were basically like, hey, Kevin, stop embezzling. Okay. And he was like, okay. And he kept his job.
Yeah. Because you've got to, it's almost like a 3-strike rule. So you've got to do your first warning, second warning, and then your third warning. And you've got to provide performance management options as well. So if you suck at your job and we all hate you and we want to fire you, we've got to performance manage you out, which is a very long and drawn out process and can take anywhere from like 3 months to a year. So you've got this, let's say, toxic person in the workplace that is just going to maintain there because it's really, really difficult. And it's kind of from that point onwards that you have to start keeping as an employer, you have to start documenting all the evidence of the times that they didn't meet the performance requirements that you've set out in this performance development plan.
That sort of sounds a little bit like government workers in the US, I think. It's hard to fire. It's hard, you know, and if you're underperforming, unless you're really grossly underperforming, you're usually going to be able to stick around for a long time past when you probably should be there.
Past your expiration date.
Yeah.
I also feel like even though like in theory, the way you guys do it in New Zealand sounds a lot more thorough and, you know, a better way to do change management or, you know, getting rid of an employee. I also feel like it opens you up to keeping, like what Stephen and you are saying, like people who are embezzling or who are really just not really pulling their weight and creating a more toxic environment. The reason why that woman told us about that story is because she left because she couldn't wrap her, that was the deciding factor for her to leave, because she was like, if they're letting Kevin Smith get away with it, who's going to say that Kevin Smith and 12 of his other, you know, team members won't start doing that? And they're letting, this is a well-known secret, but we're turning a blind eye to it. How can you run a successful organization in that manner? So I feel like it's opening yourself up to having people who aren't really pulling their weight, don't really know what they're doing, to stay in the said position that they have. Would you agree with that, Nicola?
Yeah, I do agree with that. I think that makes...
There's really no... You're always going to have toxic people. You're always going to have toxic workplaces. Like, it's like a mind fuck, right? It's like, so here's New Zealand who's doing everything properly in terms of change management and letting redundant staff go. And it sounds great. And then here's America who's just like, you didn't curl your eyelashes in the right way. You're an at-will employee, so fuck you. You're done. Today's your last day. You're kicked out of all your email. So it's like, is there a middle ground that could possibly be the sweet spot for corporations and organizations across the world? Like, what do you think about that, Stephen, seeing what you've seen through all of your clients and employees come through your door who are disgruntled? Are they all disgruntled?
Almost, yes. There, people are never happy talking to me, I would say, at the beginning.
Right.
It's such a good question. I think I agree that I'm not sure if there's a great solution. One idea is employee-owned or partially employee-owned businesses. I think people who have ownership stakes in their own work are going to do a better job and act ethically. And then if they're not, their fellow employees can terminate them more easily because they all have an ownership in the company too. So I think there's some work around
that. Is a good
more employee owned businesses, or at least partially owned.
That's very common though these days. I feel like that was something that happened years ago, like many years ago. Like, I don't think that's something that Americans even think of anymore.
Yeah. On the small scale, I feel, you know, there's a pizza shop here in Oakland that is about to become employee owned. And I was thinking, I was eating my pizza there a couple of weeks ago thinking, you know, how's this going to change the employees? Are they going to, you know, I'm assuming there would be less instances of discrimination, harassment, retaliation, also less experiences of poor performers sticking around way longer than they should. And it seems like it could really work. I think for bigger, if it was a, you know, if it was Pizza Hut, I'm not sure it would work. I think once it gets too big, it gets harder to manage when so many people have input. But I think it's an interesting idea, at least for sort of experimentation purposes.
Yeah, I don't think many people even think about that. I mean, I think years and years ago, at my first job out of college, I think technically we had employee stock options, but it was like so minimal that it didn't even make a difference in the whole grand scheme of things, because the people, you know, the higher ups had the most shares. So even if we voted on something, it didn't even really make a difference. Whatever they decided was going to be what ended up happening. So in theory, it's a good idea, but I think you're right. When it gets to be too big, it gets so watered down that you're really not, your say doesn't really make a difference anyway.
Right. And you're not waking up thinking, you know, how can I contribute to my company today? It's just, there's my employer's company I work for.
Right. Yeah.
That's so true. What do you think is important in toxic workplaces to cover off when gathering up evidence?
Well, this isn't that, but have you talked about diversity, inclusion, equity initiatives on your podcast before?
We were just talking to someone who has autism, who's very, you wouldn't really know it until he mentioned it, but who might need, you know, special accommodations. But yeah, if like, then I'm like, well, I'm special needs too, because I have a period. It's like, huh?
Right. Yeah. Right. And people have been doing that with working from home accommodations. People have been trying to come up with any possible
disability. Have they really?
Oh yeah, because it's a big deal to work from home. And as people have, as employers have required people to come back into the office, people want to stay working at home. And one of the only ways to do that is say it's a reasonable accommodation for my medical condition or disability. And so there's a lot of people who have legitimate, real disabilities and medical conditions where working from home is necessary, or at least a few days a week, and it's a reasonable accommodation. It's not going to hurt the company. It's not an undue burden. Then there are other people who just want to work from home and, you know, and can get one doctor's note saying that they have, you know, trouble driving from due to a medical condition. It would be best if they only work from home, you know, if they only work in office 3 days a week. And I think that that devalues the people who have real, genuine conditions.
Absolutely.
And so it's always a little bit tough to suss out of what's going on.
Like, why are we pushing people to go back into the office? Or I just don't understand.
Are you asking me? I don't know the answer to that.
I'm just asking in general. I'm like, it's wild in my mind. So
I have been working from home since pre-pandemic because my company's office is in New York. And when I was 6 months pregnant with my daughter, I moved to Florida. So I've been working remotely. And then the pandemic hit. And then eventually our company gave up its store, its office space, because it was like, we can do our work from literally anywhere. So there's no reason to be renting a space in on Amsterdam Avenue on the Upper West Side, like in Manhattan.
Oh, that sounds fancy.
It wasn't. It was just a small office, you know, but it was nice to have that sort of storefront, so to speak. But I hate working from home. I feel like I hate it. I feel so isolated. I feel like it does most other employees a disservice, because you and I've talked about this before, Nicola, like, because then you're relying on like, I'm dating myself, or like texting, you know, instant messenger in terms of like, whatever, it's iMessage on, you know, your phone or Slack or any of those or Teams. And it's like, if you've never seen me in person and you don't understand my personality, my mannerisms, and I've used this example before in our podcast, if I say like, oh my God, Nicola, you're killing me in a text, you don't know what that means. But if you saw me in person and I'm like, oh my God, this whole project is getting like making me go crazy, and Nicola, right now you are killing me, you would understand it was like said in a joking, non-offensive way. So I feel like it does a lot of employees a disservice, right? Because you don't really truly understand who people are. You know, maybe you'll have Zoom meetings a couple times a week, but it's usually for problem solving or, you know, like you don't really get to know someone.
But maybe that's, you know, one of the things that we need to start looking at is that we're looking more at a more hybrid community rather than just fully in the office or fully work from home, right? Where we've got that more flexibility where you're like 2 days in the office, 3 days at home.
And you know, the other thing is I also feel like when you go into the office on the flip side, there's so many more distractions. You get less work done. Like when I'm working from home, I could do what would normally take me in an office like all day in maybe 2.5 hours.
Same.
Like I'm done like this. I'm not being interrupted. I'm not, you know, doing office chit chat. I'm not getting up every 2 seconds to get water, or I'm just plowing through my work. So
yeah,
I don't know.
What is your opinion, Stephen?
Yeah, what's your opinion?
I'm pretty mixed. I think a lot of employers want to send people back to work for the wrong reasons.
What are those reasons?
Those reasons are our supervisors, mid-level managers want control, really direct control over their workers. They want to be able to see them there.
Micromanagement.
There you go.
Here you say.
And I think that's really unhealthy. I think it's nice for people, for extroverted people who want to go into the office, to be able to build that community, to be able to really understand one another, I think is important. So I like the hybrid approach. I just think that some of these companies that are now, you know, we're checking your badge swipe entries to see how many times you come to the office, for me feels a little bit like a helicopter employer. And I don't like that. But I agree with you, Gina, that I think it's helpful for building out community, actually understanding what people are saying. You can't really,
I think for morale too, right? Because like, just using me and Nicola, we didn't realize that we both like felt a certain type of way about our former employer because we were not physically together. Like maybe if I had seen her every day and we started chatting, we would have been like, maybe we should come up with an exit plan because this place fucking sucks, right? Like this is draining the life out of me. I just want to go stab myself with a blunt object in the eye. So we didn't have that opportunity. So I think maybe hybrid is the way to go because you can do your social stuff, build morale, and then go home and bang out your work and get it done in like record time. Sounds like a good plan.
Without the commute on certain days.
Yeah, exactly.
But then you've got that flip side, right? We've got our micromanagers who aren't going to like the fact that you're creating communities of work at work because you should be at work to do your work. Right. So now they're going to stifle your opportunities to create connections because they just want you to come into the office and sit at your desk and pound out work. So what the fuck is the point?
I think that would lead us into a whole different conversation about how do stupid people get in places of leadership?
Oh, my God. I hate. Stupid.
Yes. And that's the root of a lot.
Who want to micromanage being leaders, like it doesn't make any sense.
How has this happened?
And Stephen, why are we coming to you thinking you have the answers when we know you don't? But
I don't. But I think there's one problem. I think, and this is the hot button issue I was going to mention earlier with diversity, equity, inclusion. I think if there were more supervisors and managers that looked like employees, racially, you know, with religion, sexual orientation, whatever it is, I think it would lead to a more healthy workplace. And so the fact that now, ever since affirmative action's been overturned in schools in the US last spring or early summer in June, the next frontier, I think, for a lot of people on that side is how can we end diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives in the workplace. And so that worries me because I think it's going to become a lot less healthier of workplaces if there are less people that look like they're employees on the management level.
I can understand why it's an issue, right? I can understand for admissions, but I don't understand why that would then translate to a workplace.
Yeah, it's a good question. So Edward Blum is the one of the main attorneys who's who represented he took he represented mostly, I think, Asian students against Harvard, and he was largely responsible for overturning affirmative action. The Supreme Court sided with him. And then that happened this spring, and he immediately sort of declared war on companies' diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives. So he sued two big law firms saying, you have, for law students, you have fellowships for the summers for people who are historically underrepresented. So they give out some money and you do sort of an internship, and it's sort of known as it's only for people who are underrepresented at major law firms. And so he sued these big law firms saying that that is discrimination. That's discrimination against people who aren't of those historically represented groups. And so it'll be interesting to see how that ends up getting handled through the courts. I think personally that diversity, equity, inclusion is super important to a healthy workplace, and so I'm all for them. But the way that this affirmative action battle has gone, I think it's going to be interesting how.
Great. Okay. Steven, tell us where we can find you for any of our listeners, and I'm sure there's quite a few who might feel like they have a good case.
Especially all of those in California.
Yes, only California. You can find me at my website. That's probably the best place. www.chisholmlaw.com. My last name's Chisholm, so chisholmlaw.com. That's probably the best place to find me, or on LinkedIn. Those are my main avenues. No social media for now, other than LinkedIn.
So you're on LinkedIn? Okay, we'll get people to stalk you on LinkedIn.
LinkedIn's good. I'm not on, the TikTok, Instagram world for
Please
now.
don't be on TikTok. Nobody needs to be on TikTok.
There's some very popular lawyers on TikTok,
I was
but
gonna say, what do lawyers post on TikTok? Is it,
oh
and
no,
is it personal?
there's employee right like employ employment lawyer Ryan.
No, but he's Instagram, which I think is
He's on
slightly flat.
TikTok too.
Is he? I don't fuck with TikTok. I'm too old.
Fun
I'm like,
fact, top cities, Wellington, New Zealand, New York for Gina, and Los Angeles, California.
all
They
right.
listen to the podcast.
Okay, so if you guys need an employment lawyer, we know where to find you know where to find one. And we'll put all of your info in the show notes so anyone can just click it if they want to reach out to you.
Great. It
Yeah.
was such a
Well,
pleasure chatting with you both.
you too. And to everyone out there, document evidence. Is that your major like takeaway? Like document everything and don't
Document,
delete
document,
anything.
document.
And don't delete.
Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Let's Break Up, Toxic Workplace Stories. If you enjoyed our candid conversations and insights, don't forget to hit that like button, follow us on social media, and subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform.